Gina. This is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 here in Prague. It's a beautiful city.
It is a beautiful city.
Have you been here before?
I haven't, no.
It's my first time.
Yeah, me too. I've had a quick look around this morning, but now the talk's out of the way, I'm hoping to see a little bit more. And the sun's out.
Yeah, and it's really warm here.
It is. It is an extension of my summer coming from the UK.
That's right. So why don't you introduce yourself a little bit, and we'll talk a little bit about your talk, which I found very fascinating.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm Andy Hume. I currently work as a software engineer at Twitter.
Okay.
Although what I was talking about mostly in the talk was some of my experiences building a large volume news site when I was working at The Guardian.
Okay.
And the talk is all about how to respond as a web developer to things you can't control. Things like the network, right. When the network becomes a problem, when it goes down, mm-hmm. when people particularly on mobile are moving around, mm-hmm. they're going in and out of good areas of network, bad areas of network, they're going sure. into tunnels on trains, things of this nature. How can we kind of architect the code that we make to make it more resilient, to
I
make
see.
Sure people get an experience even when there's a problem.
And I think what struck home to me is if you've ever tried to load a page on your phone and like everything shows up except the text.
All right, yeah, that's exactly it.
And it's the most frustrating thing because you waited all this time for it to download all this stuff. And as a developer, there's this sense of it's not doing the most important things right now.
Right.
So what are some things we can do as developers to make our websites or whatever more resilient against these kinds of issues?
Well, it's really a case of understanding what's happening with the browser and what's happening with the network, and then making sure you kind of work within that framework. So browsers, for example, they can't show anything until they've got the HTML that they need and they've got the CSS that they need. So if you can get those two things down as quickly as possible, then you can show something. And hopefully you can show the content. You can show the information that the user came to the website for.
And the challenge is like, these CSS files are getting huge. And it feels like we're trying to get stuff out of the DOM now.
Right. Well, one of the approaches that I talked about, and it's not so common, but it's really effective, and the Guardian site uses it, is to inline some of the critical CSS actually in HTML, the head of the HTML document. Mm-hmm. So then within one HTTP request, you get the HTML and the CSS. Mm-hmm. So you've immediately reduced this dependency on making a second HTTP request for CSS because you've already got it. And the browser can do the layout and show the content for, you know, the first half of the page maybe.
So you talk about, you said something about critical CSS. Mm. How do we as developers gauge what CSS is critical and what CSS is like, okay.
That's really difficult. It's, in my experience, it's a case of trial and error.
I see.
So when we first did this at The Guardian, it was great because we got really, really fast render times, like under a second and less, in fact, on 3G networks. But we did see like the layout being a bit weird at times. So, but when we saw it being a bit weird, or when users reported to us, we'd say, well, what else can we put into the critical CSS? How can we just improve that little problem? Mm-hmm. And you kind of incrementally take it to a point where it's going to work. But it's easy for me to say because we were deploying every day and we had this instant feedback from millions of users.
Sure.
It's more difficult for some sites who don't necessarily, or some development teams don't get that feedback, or they're working with a client who's not providing that feedback.
I see.
So there's a lot of kind of organizational concerns that come with it as well. It's not an easy problem.
So it feels like make a good guess and then check it pretty robustly and then fix as you go.
Yeah, I think with performance stuff in general, do what you think is right and then measure it.
Okay.
Like, has it got faster? Has it got slower? Is the layout moving around on certain browsers and then incrementally improve?
So you talked about the most critical things before it can even show anything, HTML and CSS. But now there's a lot of work being done in JavaScript to move stuff, to be more interactive. Is there stuff you can do to improve your JavaScript performance?
I guess you could take a similar approach to CSS in the understand what is critical about the JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the case of many, many sites, the JavaScript shouldn't be critical.
Yeah.
Like, the critical piece should be the HTML. That's where your content is. That's primarily why people have come to your site. You can enhance that with JavaScript, and you can do loads of good things that your designers want you to do, and as you know, designers, developers, we want to do, and our users will like with JavaScript. But be aware, it might not always work.
I see.
Because the JavaScript might not be there. And that if you follow those kind of progressive enhancement philosophies, you get a lot of this resilience for free.
Yeah, and the crazy thing is I remember when Ajax started to become all the rage after Gmail sort of did some cool stuff with it. Like, there were some sites that would load this frame and there'd be little spinny wheels at each of the little divs, and I'm just like, this seems dumb.
Yeah, yeah. It's very difficult because we don't have a good software methodology really for building these kind of awesome sites easily. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, we're doing server-side rendering in a completely different language often to what we're doing when we render stuff with JavaScript. We haven't managed to connect these two very efficiently in terms of software development process. And people are looking into things like that, you know, calling it isomorphic JavaScript and universal JavaScript, things like this, having shared rendering logic on the server and the client. Once we have that, there's some very interesting things that we can start to experiment with.
I see.
But at the moment, we're very decoupled, and that has meant that, you know, I think the progressive enhancement philosophies are still the best approach.
I see. So we talked about the HTML, the CSS, and the JavaScript. What are some other tips that you have to make your websites not only work well when there's network problems, but just be fast?
Well, I mean, certainly another thing that you touched on at the beginning was the missing fonts. That's something that's become a real problem in the last 2 or 3 years, as you know, as font embedding has become this viable thing. Fonts are slightly weird because the page still renders without having the fonts, it just won't show you the text. So you need to take the font download out of that critical path. And there are tools that help you do that. There's a library from Google and Typekit called Web Font Loader. Mm-hmm. And that just helps you get a little bit more control about how and when you show your text, when you show your custom font, making sure that you show a fullback font until the custom one's downloaded.
I see. And so these fonts are embedded in the website, and so the whole font file needs to get downloaded in order to render it.
Yeah.
And so what you're saying is with JavaScript, and you mentioned the library, you can degrade gracefully.
Yeah. If the JavaScript fails to download, you've still shown the fullback font because that's what your HTML and CSS is saying to do. Mm-hmm. Once the font's downloaded, the JavaScript just gives you a little event that says, your font's available now, so update your CSS to show it.
I see. And will that cause sometimes your text to like show up and then just change like right after?
Yes, it may well change font as the user's looking at it. There are things you can do to make that experience a little bit more pleasant, so things don't jump around too much, making sure that the basic size of them and the line heights are similar, that words don't literally move, it's just a little flash. And it's not ideal, and a lot of people will say, I really wish it
But it's better than
do
a
that,
blank screen.
Better than a blank screen.
So you're saying degrade the font gracefully in the way that if you have a really cool font that you really just have to use, make sure that the font that you're degrading to looks similar, is the same size.
Yeah.
It's not going to change very much what's going on, but when the font does load, then you have the full experience.
And we already have this concept, right? Because in CSS, you can define a set of, a list of fonts. And if the first one's not installed, it goes to the second one. If that's not installed, it goes to the third one. Eventually, it'll fall back to whatever operating system level font it feels is appropriate. And it's the same principle, basically. It's just embracing what the browser wants to do in the first place, working with it rather than not
fighting it, right?
Fighting it.
So it's like when I saw some of these things, I was like, yeah, I know that, but no, nobody told me this. Mm. And so I think that's the cleverest things when you actually feel like you should have known something. And so any other tips for making your websites faster? You talked about you worked at The Guardian, and obviously it's full of content, and I've loaded it on my phone. It seems really fast. Any other things that sort of jump out at you that you can do?
Well, I guess the thing I would say is less a technical thing, and it's more a cultural thing about how you make people care. Mm-hmm. And I think how you make people care is to show them it, is to measure it. Like the first thing, before you can say, I want to improve the performance of my site, you have to know what the performance of your site is so that you know whether it's getting better or worse.
Right.
And sometimes people have difficulty convincing other stakeholders of the importance of performance. If you can show your performance compared to your competitors, maybe you can show how your performance degraded when you added this new feature and how that impacted page views maybe. There's lots of studies that say the load time of your web page is directly correlated to the number of page views you get.
Yeah.
Because people, if it's slow, they don't wait around.
I'm not gonna
they
wait
go
around.
Away. Yeah. So if you could, I mean, many companies have experimented with introducing a false delay. Just say, let's just hold every page back 200 milliseconds. and let's see if our page views drop. And if you can do that experiment and show it to everybody, then, you know,
I feel like it's won. I feel like it's kind of intuitive. The longer the page loads, the more frustrated people are going to get, and the more they're going to say, I'm not going to go there, I could go somewhere else.
Yeah, I think it is understood more generally, that that relationship between performance and core business metrics, like page views and ad impressions and revenue. But it's not always easy, you know. If you're working with large, long, complex sites that were built 10 years ago, it's not always easy to kind of introduce some of these best practices of today.
So let's finish up with two things. The first thing is, what tools can you use to see the impact, or maybe to get a gauge of how you might improve things? And then let's start with that. How do you, what tools can you use to gauge things?
So the, I guess the canonical web page performance tool is Webpage Test. That is really straightforward to use, kind of ad hoc. You just go, you put a URL into it, and it gives you a lot of data about what your site's doing. It will give you waterfall charts, you know, showing you directly what the browser is downloading, when it's downloading it. That's a really useful tool. If you can somehow build that into your process, then even better. If every time you launch the site, it automatically
tests.
Yeah, sent it to Webpage Test and gave you a new time. Like, this is now your load time. Chart it over time. Actually, there's a good tool that's newer on the market. I think it's called Speed Curve.
Okay.
And if you go to speedcurve.com, this does all that for you. You put in your URL and it will track it over time, and it will track it against your competitors and things like that.
That's awesome.
It's a lovely site to use as well. It's really well designed.
And so, but you can also use like built-in the dev tools in Chrome or IE, the F12 tools in IE, because it builds that chart.
Yeah.
And if you can see what is causing holds up, you can actually learn to move stuff up the stack a little bit.
Yeah. No, absolutely. The web dev tools have those, the waterfalls in them. There's a tool as well called the Critical Path Explorer, which Google created, and they used to have it available as a tool that anyone could use, and they removed it for some reason that I never quite understood, because it, actually for me it was the one tool that kind of informed me the most about what browsers are doing and how they work.
And what did it do?
Well, it was, in essence, it was a waterfall chart showing all of the different assets loading in, but then it also showed you exactly what part of those the browser was working on at any given time.
As
the HTML came in, it would say, now there's some HTML parsing going on. And then as a script came in, it would show you that the HTML parsing has stopped because it's gone off to download a script. That's going to come back. Now it's showing you that it's parsing JavaScript, executing JavaScript. Once it's done that, it goes back to the HTML. And it shows you this critical path, as they called it, actually content being available to see.
Because
on
then
the screen.
You could see, like, wow, this is actually more important, but for some reason this other thing got in front of it.
Yeah, exactly that. And it's very clear when you see it in those in that visual way.
So I promised two questions. The second question is legacy. You have a legacy large web application. How do you even start?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really difficult problem. And when I was at The Guardian, we had that problem because we had a site that was built 7 or 8 years ago. And in a way, building the new one was easy because we had this blank slate and we could just do what the best practices were. The old site, we struggled with a lot more. One thing that we did find effective was there's a Apache module that Google created called Mod PageSpeed, and it's pretty smart. What it tries to do is it analyzes your site kind of in real time as users request it, and then it figures out how it can push some of these best practices into your legacy code by moving things around, like without you knowing. So what comes down to the user has been like changed. So they might concatenate some JavaScript files together and then change the link to point to the new one, which is a little bit frightening for some people because they like the control. I was initially worried about that approach, but frankly, with the legacy site, that it gave us performance benefits, and we could just leave it and concentrate on the new stuff.
Interesting. So you're saying maybe intercept as it's going on. I mean, in ASP.NET, we have these things called web handlers that you can sort of put in the middle and start to look at what you can pass up and down.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a similar thing for IIS or whatever.
I don't know either. It would be interesting.
I mean, I guess the rules that are in Mod PageSpeed are portable. It could be built in.
Well, this is super helpful. I mean, the thing about development is we kind of, especially when we're in greenfield or maybe even brownfield application, we get in there, we're pretty excited about doing our stuff, but we tend not to think about these little things. We tend to take the important CSS stuff out into another page that's going to block. We tend to maybe not put the JavaScript at the end, which causes the DOM to not load all the way. And so this is very helpful, man. Where can people look you up if they want to ask you questions?
Probably the best place would be Twitter.
Okay.
Right, if you at me on Twitter or DM me on Twitter, anyone can DM me. Mm-hmm. I'm more than happy to
awesome. Any questions. What's that Twitter handle for everyone?
Oh, it's Andy Hume,
okay,
which is my name all in
fantastic.
Together.
Well, thanks so much for spending some time with
welcome.
Us. Thanks so much for watching, and we will catch you next time. Take care.